This episode contains strong language, adult situations, and mentions of sexual abuse.
Please be advised.
It's 1985 in New York City, and 21-year-old Whitney Houston is sitting in a high-end Manhattan salon. The place is filled with clients paying top dollar to get seriously dolled up, but Whitney is not feeling it. Her record label wants her to consider getting a weave, and she's fighting the urge to get up and run. It's just a consultation, not a commitment, she reminds herself. No one ever died from a consultation, right? So why does it feel like she's about to lose something? Whitney's debut single, You Give Good Love, from her self-titled debut album, is rising on the charts. So far, everything in her career has fallen into place like a fairy tale. Today, though, that tale has a twist she did not see coming. Her record label doesn't like her hair, which at the moment is short, cropped, and natural. Her manager told her that before she heads out on her European tour, the label wants her to have what they call Vanessa Williams hair. Vanessa's just become the first Black woman to be crowned Miss America. Her hair is blown out and puffy, like something straight out of the TV show Dynasty. Clive Davis, the head of Whitney's label Arista, wants her to have a similar look. So now, here she is, fidgeting in a salon chair, awaiting her fate. Two stylists descend and start picking Whitney's hair apart. They say it's too short on the sides and might not even be strong enough to support a weave. One even suggests they shave it and put Whitney in a wig. They talk about her like she's not even there. Whitney feels her eyes welling up, but she tells herself, I will not cry in front of them.
God, if Tyra Banks wasn't 12 years old in 1985, I'd assume she was behind this.
I mean, she was. She came out and said, you want to be on top?
I thought that sounded familiar.
Now, when the consultation is over, Whitney heads back to the car with her best friend and assistant, Robin Crawford. And that's when the dam breaks loose. Whitney sobs in Robin's arms. She feels like she's given up her life for the label, but it'll never be enough. Robin softly strokes her hair and tells her everything will be okay. But Whitney's not convinced, and she cries all the way home. All she's ever wanted to do was sing. She feels like God gave her an incredible gift, and she's meant to lift people up. She knows she's perfectly capable of doing that with the hair she has. But sadly, that's just not how the music industry works. So a few days later, she makes an appointment with a new stylist who sends Whitney out to choose her own hair for her weave. Whitney and Robin go to a store in Manhattan that sells every kind of hair you can imagine. Asian hair, Hawaiian hair, Indian hair. It takes hours, but they finally find some hair that matches Whitney's in color and texture. And as the cashier rings her up, a shudder goes through her body. She never thought she'd need a bag of someone else's hair to become Whitney Houston. She thought she already was Whitney Houston. But apparently, she thought wrong.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com.
We know you have your tried and true closet staples, but it can be fun to switch it up. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada.
Yeah, it's easy to find instant inspiration at Saks.com. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch.
Okay, well, obviously this is making me just want to shop after we record this.
I know, and it doesn't take much for me wanting to shop.
No.
So. But if you're looking for a joyful shopping escape, which we all are,
yes,
then head to Saks.com for inspiring ways to shop for everything on your agenda.
Saks.com.
From Wondery, I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And this is Even the Rich, where we bring you absolutely true and absolutely shocking stories about the biggest celebrities the world has ever seen.
It's a show about power, how you get it, how you keep it, and what happens when you nearly lose it all.
It's also about how the rich are just like us, because even the rich fall in love and break up and struggle.
And try to save their marriage by signing on to a reality show.
Mm-hmm. Whitney Houston's voice was in a class of its own. Her talent defined a generation and moved everyone who was lucky enough to experience it. She made her debut with the looks of a cover girl and the voice of an angel. But that was who the world wanted her to be, not who she really was. And they were merciless when the halo slipped. Whitney felt trapped between different worlds, black versus white, R&B versus pop, gay versus straight, and drugs were the only thing that helped her deal with the mounting pressure. In the end, Whitney never got the chance to just be herself. Over the next four episodes, we'll tell you how the conflicting demands of loved ones, the music industry, and even the public ate away at an incomparable voice. And we'll explore the question everyone wants an answer to. If Whitney had been allowed to fully live with all her contradictions, would she still be with us today? This is episode one, Newark State of Mind. It's 1972 in East Orange, New Jersey. 9-year-old Whitney Houston is in the basement of her family home, singing her tiny lungs out to a Cher song. Whitney's obsessed with the Sonny and Cher show, and she's determined to recreate it. So she's borrowed one of her mother's glittery stage gowns. Sissy Houston is a member of the background vocal group, the Sweet Inspirations, and she wears the sparkly dresses when she's singing for artists like Elvis Presley, Dusty Springfield, Aretha Franklin, and Jimi Hendrix. A couple times over the years, it looked like Sissy might become a star in her own right. But somehow, it never quite happened. Lucky for Whitney, Sissy still has the wardrobe of a headliner. Whitney completes her Cher ensemble with high heels and one of Sissy's long black wigs. She grabs a mop for her microphone and then makes her older brother Michael play Sonny, even though he'd rather be anywhere else. "I got you, babe," he sings, doing his best impression of Sonny Bono. But Whitney keeps stopping to yell at him. Michael's tone is way off. Whitney doesn't have that problem, of course. She's got perfect pitch.
That makes two of us.
Well, if we're living in fantasy land, then it makes three of us.
We are, thank you.
Singing is Whitney's happy place. Her voice is big and rich, and she's got a full-throated belt you'd never believe could come out of a person that small. Singing makes her feel powerful. When she sings, she feels connected to something magical. Whitney finishes the number and dashes behind Sissy's costume rack for a quick change.
I mean, you can't do Cher without at least one costume change. It's the law.
This is true. Her father, John, opens the basement door and shouts down at her. "Do you have to be so loud, Nippy? I'm watching TV." Now, Nippy is Whitney's nickname, and John is the one who gave it to her. It's what everyone calls her. "I'm not Nippy. I'm Cher," she shouts back up the stairs. John then asks if Cher has to be so loud. "Yes," Whitney responds, and then she bursts into her next solo. Sissy sides with her daughter and tells John that Nippy is making her lungs strong because she wants to sing. That's right, Whitney thinks, and then she launches into her grand finale, loudly. Having both her parents at home makes Whitney's basement shows extra fun. For the first 6 years of her life, they were both gone a lot. Whitney's earliest years were spent in a working-class neighborhood in Newark. Her house was near the center of the 1967 Newark riots, which left 26 people dead. Whitney and her brothers heard gunshots throughout the night and saw the flames from nearby fires. When they were really little, the Houston siblings would play in a nearby burned-out building and jump from the roof onto an old mattress.
God, Whitney's such an icon. She even paved the way for Johnny Knoxville.
I know. Who would have thought? And since the Houstons couldn't afford to move, Sissy decided to step up her music career to bring in more money. She spent months on end touring on the road, often taking John along as a manager. So Whitney and her older brothers, Michael and Gary, were sent to stay with different family members and friends. Sissy told herself she was leaving her children in God's protective care. But these were hard, lonely times for all three kids. During this time, two cousins figured prominently in the kids' lives, Dion and Dee Dee Warwick. They were both singers, but Dee Dee wasn't nearly as famous as Dion. The kids would often stay with Dion when she was on the road.
I hate that reading Dion's tweets is the closest I'll ever get to hanging out with her.
Yeah, same.
God, they're gold.
I mean, traveling with Dion Warwick was a little kid's and adult's dream. They'd stay in nice hotels and order literally everything off the room service menu. But then things took a very dark turn. The 2018 documentary Whitney revealed that Whitney was sexually molested by Dee Dee when she was a child. Mm. Her older brother Gary says Dee Dee abused him as well.
Jeez.
None of the kids ever told John and Sissy about any of it. But it's clear that during those painful years, the siblings relied on each other for a lifeline. The trauma they went through bonded them together for life. After a couple of years on the road, Sissy lands a solo contract. With her advance, she and John buy a large four-bedroom house in the middle-class neighborhood of East Orange. It's 6 miles and a world away from their old house in Newark. It's 1975 in East Orange, New Jersey, and 11-year-old Whitney is trembling in the kitchen. Six girls from school have followed her home so they can beat her up. Whitney's been a bully magnet since kindergarten. She's lighter skinned than most of her classmates, and kids mistake her shyness for arrogance. But mostly, Whitney just stands out. Sissy dresses her up like a little doll in frilly plaid skirts and shiny Mary Jane shoes, when the rest of the class is wearing jeans and sneakers. The girls shout for Whitney to come out and fight. Whitney throws Sissy a desperate look and tells her she just wants them all to be friends. But Sissy gives her the hard truth. That's not the way the world is, baby.
Sissy's right. Let those assholes go back to singing off key or whatever the hell they do in their spare time.
Yeah, becoming a ragtag team of annoying karaoke singers.
Mm-hmm.
But Sissy's had to fight for everything in her life. And she wants her sensitive daughter to be made of tougher stuff. She tells Whitney that if she doesn't stand up for herself, the abuse will never stop. So Whitney plucks up her strength and steps out onto the porch to face her preteen oppressors. But just as Whitney's about to try her hand at fighting, her brother Michael shows up. He says if any of them lay a hand on Nippy, he'll kick their asses. The neighborhood girls scatter, and Whitney doesn't have to throw a single punch. Everyone's happy, except for Sissy. As far as she's concerned, Whitney's fear of confrontation is a big problem. It's 1975 in Newark, New Jersey, and Whitney is sitting in a pew at New Hope Baptist Church. She's listening to the sermon, and she's into it. The fact that Sissy's out of town helps. Without her mother there to tell her to sit up straight or fix her hair, Whitney can focus on the pastor's speech. And today, he's talking about her favorite subject, Jesus Christ. Whitney's hanging on his every word. Whitney loves Jesus the way other girls her age love Michael Jackson. He's her teen idol.
Weird, I missed his spread in Tiger Beat.
You know it was a bestseller. For Whitney, church has always been a welcome escape from the hell of school. It's a safe haven where no bullies can get to her. Lately, though, she's been feeling a genuine connection to something bigger. Today, she can literally feel it in her body. It's like a vibration that starts in the soles of her feet and spreads to the top of her head. And when the pastor starts talking about how Jesus said, "Suffer the little children," she feels like Jesus himself is offering relief for her pain. The power of the moment becomes too much to contain. Whitney bursts into tears and doesn't stop until the service is over. That night, when Sissy gets home and asks if anything interesting happened at church, Whitney is quick to respond. "Yes, Mommy, something interesting did happen. I got saved." New Hope becomes a place where Whitney's two passions, singing and Jesus, come together to form something special. Whitney wants to be in the church choir, and Sissy is the perfect teacher. So Sissy treats her to hours and hours of vocal training. She's a tough teacher and makes Whitney master her voice with lots of drills and exercises. Sissy figures if she wants to sing, she's got to do it right. When Sissy feels something is missing from Whitney's performance, she'll make her do it again and again until she gets it right. Sometimes she and Whitney will get in fights that start at choir practice and continue long after they get home.
Please tell me the fights are only sung.
Oh my God. That's the only way I want to fight from now on.
Okay. I'm in.
But Sissy's bulldozing pays off. Soon enough, Whitney becomes the star attraction at New Hope. But even though the church lifts her up, Sissy's constant criticism makes Whitney feel small. But that's not Whitney's biggest problem. Her parents' marriage is imploding. John and Sissy are always at each other's throats, yelling and slamming doors and accusing each other of cheating. Her brothers, who are still just teenagers, move out. They crash with friends so they can avoid the drama. But as the youngest, Whitney doesn't have that option. The girl who hates confrontation is left right in the middle of the war zone, trying to play peacemaker. But Whitney's starting to crack under the pressure. She needs something to take the edge off. And on her 14th birthday, she finally finds it. It's August 1977, and Whitney's celebrating her birthday with her brother Michael. He's the person she feels closest to in the world. Right now, she's over at the place he's staying. It's kind of a dump, but at least no one's fighting. Michael brings her into the bathroom and gives Whitney her present. He tells her to close her eyes and hold out her hands, and Whitney does as she's told. Michael places a plastic Ziploc bag in her hands. Whitney smiles. She knows exactly what it is. She smoked pot a few times before with Michael and loved how it made her feel. All the problems with her parents felt like they were a million miles away. But then Michael hands her another, smaller baggie, and it's full of white powder. She's heard of this stuff, but she's never seen it up close. Michael taps the cocaine out onto the counter and cuts a line. Then he rolls up a bill and hands it to Whitney. She looks into Michael's eyes. He's always been her safe person to be dangerous with. She remembers jumping off the roof of the burned-out building with him. She would trust him with her life. So Whitney does the line. A few minutes later, when the high kicks in, she thinks, "This is the best birthday ever." In high school, Whitney starts to live a double life. Each morning, she says goodbye to her parents dressed in her school uniform. But once she's out of their sight, she ditches class and hangs out at Dunkin' Donuts all day.
I mean, to be fair, it's better than, like, a meth lab.
Are we sure about that?
I don't know.
Her dad still sees her as his little girl, and Sissy sees her as her obedient little protege. But her brothers see her as the third musketeer in their misadventures. It's 1978, and Sissy Houston is supposed to be heading out the door for a gig at Mikel's Jazz Club in Manhattan. Instead, she calls Whitney into her bedroom.
"I'm too sick to sing,"
Sissy informs her.
"You'll have to fill in for me."
Whitney's eyes go wide. A rush of fear floods her body. There's no way she's ready for this. But Sissy tells her she can handle it. It's time to stop practicing and get out into the real world.
Oh yeah, is that what you told yourself 5 years ago when you were pretending to go to a job you already quit?
Oh my God.
The lies.
I cannot comment on that. 2 hours later, Whitney's standing backstage at Mikel's. Her stomach is doing somersaults as she hears the MC announce that Sissy Houston has fallen ill, but her 14-year-old daughter Whitney will be taking her place. The crowd applauds politely as Whitney walks awkwardly out onto the stage. As the music starts, she gets into the zone. She imitates everything she's seen Sissy do, right down to the between song banter, word for word. The crowd loves it. Seeing a teenager imitate the mannerisms of a grown woman is both charming and hilarious. As the show goes on, Whitney grows more confident. Her voice explodes out of her. And by the time she belts her final song, "I Am Changing" from Dreamgirls, it's her show. She kills it. The next morning, Whitney notices that Sissy's voice is completely back to normal. When she asks her about it, Sissy smiles slyly. "Oh, I was never sick. I was just seeing if you could cut it." It's 1978 in East Orange, New Jersey, and John and Sissy Houston are in the throes of an epic screaming match. Whitney's in her room, trying to block it out. She puts on Chaka Khan's debut album to drown out the hollering. Sissy sang backup vocals on the record and took Whitney to the studio to watch the recording session. Whitney closes her eyes and sings along. But not even Chaka Khan on full blast is a match for her loudly raging parents. Finally, something snaps inside her. She marches out and plants herself between them. Then she turns to her father and says, "Daddy, if you're gonna leave, then just do it." Soon after, he does. From that point on, John and Sissy are separated. But they come back together on any occasion that involves their daughter's burgeoning music career. To the public, they play the role of the perfect, loving Christian family. But behind the scenes, it's a shit show. Whitney feels lost. She doesn't have anyone to turn to. Not even her brothers are around very much anymore. Whitney desperately longs for emotional support. She needs a safe haven that has nothing to do with her fucked up family. It's the summer of 1980, and Whitney is slumped over in a folding chair in the East Orange Development Center. Sissy insisted she get a summer job, but she doesn't want Whitney to launch her solo singing career until after she graduates high school. Whitney thinks that's bullshit. She's starting to get her own backup singing gigs now, and she'd much rather be in a studio. But Sissy is insistent. So here Whitney is, applying for a summer job as a camp counselor. Whitney's considering sneaking out to smoke a joint when a tall, striking young woman approaches her with a clipboard. She's wearing lime green shorts, white Nikes, and is sporting a fierce, short afro. Her name is Robin Crawford, and she and Whitney chat about high school and living in Jersey. Whitney doesn't know what it is about this girl, but her heart is racing. As Robin turns to leave at the end of their conversation, she says, "Well, I'll keep an eye out for you, Whitney Elizabeth Houston." The pair soon start hanging out together after camp hours. It turns out that Robin is an amazing listener. Whitney finally has someone to share all those feelings she's been keeping bottled up. Robin listens without trying to change her, and Whitney's in awe of Robin's take-me-or-leave-me attitude. Whitney's never been able to let go of what other people think of her. With Robin, Whitney can finally be herself, 100%. She finally has a friend. But she has no idea that soon, this girl who makes her feel so safe will terrify everyone else in her life.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen. And you know, I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text Even the Rich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text Even the Rich to 500-500 to get started. When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
And I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
My God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
It's the summer of 1980 in East Orange, New Jersey, and Whitney and Robin are strolling through Whitney's neighborhood. They're not going anywhere in particular. They're just wandering, laughing, and talking. Whitney's telling Robin about her recent experience, singing backup for Chaka Khan on her second album, Naughty. She tells Robin about the moment Chaka stopped the session and called Whitney's name. At first, she was scared she was about to be fired. But instead, Chaka told her to move closer to the mic. She liked what Whitney was doing. "I'm telling you, Robin," Whitney says, "it was like being anointed by the queen." The girls head back to Whitney's house and plop down on the floor of the living room. As they talk, their faces grow closer. Whitney feels pulled toward Robin by a feeling she can't identify. She has to kiss her. So she does. Their kiss is long, slow, and sweet like honey. When their lips part, Whitney spots the look of surprise on Robin's face. What happened to the good little church girl? But Whitney's not conflicted. She leans in and says seductively, "If I knew when my brothers were coming over, I'd really show you something."
Ooh, okay, Whitney.
Yeah, get it, girl. People think Whitney's a babe in the woods being led astray, but she's not that interested in staying on the straight and narrow, especially now that she's met Robin. After their kiss, Whitney and Robin make things official. They don't tell a soul they're dating, but their deep bond is obvious. They dress alike, walk around arm in arm, and they have their own private jokes. Kids at camp make kissing sounds when they walk by. Some even call them dykes, but the girls don't care. They're in love.
All right, I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume Sissy doesn't like Robin.
Wow, that's a hell of a limb, and you are 100% right. It was disdain at first sight for Sissy. She never misses a chance to diss Robin to Whitney. But Whitney's longed for this kind of unconditional love and acceptance all her life. She's not going to give it up now. In fact, she wants to share even more of who she really is with Robin. So she invites her to come hear her sing at New Hope. It's the first Sunday in August in 1980, and the pews of New Hope Church are filled to capacity. Whitney is standing with the church choir at the altar in a floor-length white robe, about to begin her solo. Robin is sitting in the seventh row, and Whitney can feel her eyes on her, waiting along with everyone else. As she steps forward, a stillness takes over the room. Whitney can feel the anticipation. They're all waiting for her to sing. She closes her eyes and lets her voice loose. It's high and clear and powerful. Whitney fills the entire room with music. And as she sings her heart out, the effect on the congregants is immediate. People are fanning themselves, speaking in tongues, and cheering her on.
This is like a glimpse into the future at our first live show.
Yep, exactly.
Can't wait.
Whitney keeps her eyes closed through most of the song. As the hymn builds, a woman in the front row actually passes out. Also going to happen at our live show.
Mm-hmm.
Two other congregants rush to revive her, but Whitney's oblivious to the activity happening around her. All she cares about is channeling the divine message of her hymn. When the song is over, Whitney quietly steps back and rejoins the rest of the choir. Her job is done. After the performance, Robin gushes to Whitney about how amazing she was. She asks what it feels like to move an entire audience like that. Whitney just shrugs and says, "They should be moved, but that's the power of the Lord, not me." Whitney's not in it for her own glory. She wants God to get the glory. Before leaving New Hope that day, Whitney asks Robin to come sleep over at a friend's house. Their parents will be out of town, and they can have the whole place to themselves. So that night, they meet up at the house. Whitney lights up a joint, and they settle into a love seat.
Okay.
And then Whitney starts reading Robin some of her favorite Bible passages.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Her favorites are all about Jesus. "He's so cool, isn't he?" Whitney says between tokes. "I want to meet this man." But eventually, Whitney puts down the Bible, and she and Robin get to more important matters. Matters like kissing. That night, they sleep together for the first time. It's urgent, tender, and loving. When it's over, they fall asleep in each other's arms. As Whitney's secret romance begins to blossom, so does a new career. She's scouted by the Click Modeling Agency and quickly signs with them. She starts appearing in magazines like Essence, Harper's Bazaar, and Cosmopolitan. She even graces the cover of Seventeen. The work itself doesn't excite her, but she loves the independence of making her own money. Her own paycheck means she can have more fun with Robin. They even splurge on the occasional hotel room for coke-fueled rendezvous.
So like when you and I get an Airbnb in the city we already live in and just order Cheesecake Factory?
Yeah, literally the same, with less coke.
Yeah.
Whitney's bouncing between her image as a fresh-faced, wholesome cover girl and her real life as a wild and crazy party girl. For anyone else, it would be a contradiction. But Whitney's become a pro at keeping both sides of her life separate. She'll be the good girl in front of others, then let her hair down when she's with Robin. This way, everyone's happy. She finally gets to be who she really is. It's the fall of 1980 in New York. Whitney and Robin are driving up to Harlem in Dee Dee's Cadillac to score some blow. They park their boat of a car, and a young guy leads them into a run-down, vacant building. They end up in a dingy room, where a man sits at a table with a lamp, a scale, and a pile of white powder, flanked by two henchmen. A cloudy gray film permeates the entire room, like an Instagram filter for drug den. Whitney turns and realizes Robin isn't by her side anymore. She's lurking by the door with a look on her face that says, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. Whitney sits across from the man and makes the deal. Once the coke is in her hand, she and Robin get out of there as fast as they can. They hit the sidewalk and laugh, giddy at what they've just gotten away with. Just then, a trio of young men approach. One calls out to Whitney, telling her he knows who she is. He points to her face as if he's trying to place her. Her heart starts to race. She recently filmed a couple of national commercials for Scope and Canada Dry, so it's very possible that he's seen her on TV.
I thought I was the only one who recognized random people from commercials.
You and me both. Now, though, Whitney feels panicked. The girls jump in the car and take off, vowing that going forward, Robin will do all sketchy drug runs alone. Whitney's got an image to protect. She can't take risks like this anymore. Whitney and Robin's partying continues to rev up. When they're high, they daydream about their future together. Whitney will blow up as a singer, and Robin will make moves behind the scenes. During these talks, Whitney says, "Cocaine can't go where we're going." But then she'll change her mind. "We'll just do it a little bit longer." Whitney and Robin's drug use escalates to the point that Robin breaks down and confesses to her mother. Now, that would have been bad enough, except Robin's mother calls Sissy.
Uh-oh.
But when Whitney and Robin meet up to discuss the fallout from their respective mom talks, Whitney shrugs and says it wasn't a big deal at all.
Wait, so Sissy is mad about her being with Robin, but not about her doing the bug shug?
Yeah, she needs to reevaluate her priorities.
Yeah.
But the jury's still out on whether she didn't believe Robin's mom or if she was just lying to herself. I mean, she did say in her 2012 memoir that she still has no idea if Whitney started using drugs back then or not. She also said she honestly didn't really want to know. But either way, Whitney's in the clear for now. As Whitney gets closer to her high school graduation, she performs in a series of industry showcases. Big music labels start reaching out. One night, the massive label Arista turns up with a bouquet of flowers and an offer for a record deal. The next night, the equally big label Elektra shows up with a bigger bouquet of flowers and an even higher offer. Whitney ultimately signs with the man of her dreams, Clive Davis at Arista. It's not the biggest offer financially, but Clive Davis's reputation precedes him. He's known in the industry as a star maker, pure and simple. He's the mastermind behind the careers of artists like Barry Manilow and Billy Joel. And he helped revive the careers of artists like Whitney's cousin, Dionne Warwick, and her auntie Re, our queen of soul, Aretha Franklin.
Real quick, can we just talk about how I used to call you Auntie Rita Sargi? You're basically Aretha Franklin.
I mean, say less. But before signing with Clive, Whitney fights for and gets a key man clause, which is huge. For a new artist like Whitney, it means guaranteed personalized attention from Davis. It also means that if Clive Davis ever leaves Arista, Whitney can leave too, even if her contract isn't up. Labels don't generally like key man clauses, but Clive's been searching for a crossover pop diva like Whitney for years. He's more than happy to hitch his wagon to hers. In fact, in his entire career, Whitney is the only artist Clive Davis ever gives a key man clause to. That's how much he believes in her. It's the spring of 1983 in New Jersey, and Whitney is standing on the doorstep of Robin's mother's apartment. The ink is barely dry on Whitney's deal with Arista, and she can't wait to start recording. But first, there's something she has to do. Robin welcomes her inside, and their legs touch as they sit on the sofa. Whitney hands Robin a wrapped box, and when she opens it, Robin finds a Bible with a beautiful slate blue cover. Whitney explains she got her the gift to symbolize a new phase in their relationship. And then she tells her the bottom line. They can't be physical anymore. Robin's face falls, but she's not entirely surprised. The pair has often talked about how hard it would be to ever be open about their romantic relationship. No matter how they looked at it, it was always a non-starter.
I really fucking hate that for them.
Yeah, it's shitty. But this is the early 1980s, and unfortunately, people weren't nearly as open. I mean, this is a full decade before Katie Lang and Melissa Etheridge came out. But even if being gay were more accepted, Whitney isn't sure enough about her own sexuality to want to be a poster girl for it. She knows she's attracted to men too. She's confused in a way that Robin isn't, and there aren't really any resources out there to help her. And God knows she can't talk about it with her parents or with Clive. He thinks he's just signed his golden goose. Strangely enough, though, Clive ends up coming out as bisexual in his memoir years later. The bottom line, though, is now Whitney's making it clear that she and Robin can't express their love sexually anymore.
Not me over here being way too invested in a relationship I literally just found out about.
Truly, how did we not know this?
I don't know. I think we're the only ones.
Whitney takes Robin's hands in hers and says, "You know what we shared. You know how I feel about you, and we will always have that." They each write a page about their love in the back of the Bible, pledging that they will always be honest and loyal to each other. And then they literally close the book on their secret romance.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories. Promo code IFSTORIES10 to get your magnesium breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/IFSTORIES. Promo code IFSTORIES10.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. It's June 23rd, 1983 in Los Angeles, California. A nervous 19-year-old Whitney Houston is about to make her national television debut as a singer on the Merv Griffin Show. She's wearing a purple off-the-shoulder top with puffy sleeves. Sissy is there with her, and she can sense Whitney's anxiety. Sissy squeezes her hand and tells her to go out there and sing the song the way it's meant to be sung.
Here's Whitney Houston.
So that's what Whitney tries to do. But something's off. The band's playing a lot slower than she's used to. Whitney tries not to panic. Ignore them, she tells herself. Sing it the way it's supposed to be sung. Suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, she sees Sissy disappear from the wings and head behind the band curtain. A few bars later, the tempo picks up.
Listen, if you want to get shit done, leave it to a stage mom.
Oh, preach. And the quicker tempo is exactly what Whitney needs to find her groove. As she sings, the song builds to a roof-raising climax. And after a killer final riff, the studio erupts into enthusiastic applause. Merv and Clive rush over to embrace Whitney. "You won't forget that name," Merv gushes. It's a statement, and a prophecy. Whitney and Clive begin working on her debut album by selecting songs in Clive's plush Manhattan office. In a savvy move, Clive put together showcases on both coasts for Whitney to perform for the industry's hottest songwriters. Blown away by her powerhouse voice, the writers submitted their best songs in the hopes of being part of her sure-to-be platinum album. Now, Whitney and Clive are sorting through their treasure trove of demos. They sit across the room from each other and watch the other's body language as the songs play. More often than not, they agree on which ones are keepers. One song they instantly agree on is How Will I Know.
You know what? Season 14 Brooke would have sung right now, but I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, our self-restraint this arc will be the stuff of legends.
Yep.
Once they choose a song, Clive pairs Whitney with a producer he thinks will really help the track to pop. Then she goes in to record. And Whitney likes to get in and get out. She nails her lead vocal on How Will I Know in one take. Even though Whitney moves fast, she always wants to go faster. But Clive's taken his time. He's determined to get every ingredient right. It's 1984, and Whitney and Robin are driving down a highway in Woodbridge, New Jersey. They're not far from the two-bedroom condo they moved into together.
Okay, I can see moving in with your ex to combat LA prices, but in Jersey?
I know, there's no excuse. But so far, they've stayed true to their pact. And now Whitney's heading home from a trip to LA. Clive sent her there to work with Jermaine Jackson on some duets. And it went well. Maybe a little too well. Because they ended up hooking up. Even though Jermaine is married.
Oh, God.
And now Whitney is smitten. Whitney knows she can't tell Robin, because it will definitely upset her. But Robin knows Whitney too well. She can sense that something happened in LA. She just doesn't know for sure. Every time she tries to talk about it, Whitney finds a way out. She ignores her and turns up the radio and sings along to a love song. It's more than Robin can take. She snaps and takes a swing at Whitney right there in the car. Their car nearly swerves off the road.
Ooh, yikes.
Yeah. Robin apologizes immediately, and she insists on walking back to the condo. So Whitney drives the car home, but her hands are still shaking. When Robin finally returns, she plops down on Whitney's bedroom floor and spills her guts. She tells Whitney how jealous she feels and how it hurts even more that Whitney won't tell her what happened in LA. Whitney feels bad for Robin, and she's had enough of the lies. She breaks down and tells her all about what happened that weekend. She met Jermaine at the studio, and he laid it on thick with the compliments. She couldn't help herself. She fell for him. Whitney tells Robin that she and Jermaine snuck out to a hotel three times. Robin doesn't say a word. Then she gets up, walks into her bedroom, and starts throwing shit around. She pulls clothes from the closet, throws shoes against the wall, and flips over furniture. But Whitney doesn't intervene. She lets her rage. And when she's gotten it all out, she calmly tells Robin, "Now clean it up."
I mean, can't risk losing that security deposit.
Yeah. I mean, how else are you supposed to respond to an adult tantrum?
Yeah.
It's Whitney's way of saying, "Look, we made a plan. I'm sticking to the plan." She and Robin aren't together anymore. She's a free agent. Either Robin has to accept that, or she has to go. It's the fall of 1983, and Whitney and Robin are visiting Whitney's father, John, at his bachelor pad in Newark. He moved here after separating from Sissy. Now, Whitney's a daddy's girl at heart, so she's glad their relationship is in a better place than it was right after the split. John's a better dad on his own, and he loves hearing about Whitney's recording sessions. Both John and Sissy believe that Whitney's about to be huge. The kind of huge that can change the whole family's lives. But things take a turn when the conversation comes around to Whitney and Robin's relationship. John tells them that people are starting to gossip, and he says it right in front of Robin.
And Robin was like, "Yeah, I'm the one who started spreading the word. Glad it's getting out."
Yep, definitely happened. Whitney asks if Sissy is behind this inquisition, but John won't say where he's getting his intel. He just knows that people are calling the two of them lesbians. He thinks they have to do something about it. Whitney can't afford to jeopardize her reputation. But Whitney is pissed. She tells her dad in no uncertain terms that she has no intention of ditching Robin. She needs her best friend by her side as she navigates the business. John tells them that they can still be friends, but he suggests they find a couple of guys for a double date to the movies.
Okay, is he gonna sit a couple rows back like they're 15?
Mm-hmm, and pay for their popcorn.
Oh, nice.
The comment wounds Whitney. She knows her father means well, but she thought he'd be on her side. She'd hoped he would care about his daughter's happiness, but all he cares about is maintaining her public image. He's just like everyone else. Later, back at home, Whitney tells Robin not to worry about what other people are saying. They know the truth. But the inconvenient truth is that whether they're sleeping together or not, Whitney and Robin share a deep, profound love. And anyone with eyes can see it. Whitney's self-titled debut album is released on Valentine's Day in 1985. Finishing the record took 2 years and cost nearly twice the original budget. But it's everything she and Clive Davis ever dreamed of for her debut. Whitney's proud of the music she made, and she loves the cover art as well. She's wearing her natural hair slicked back with a cream-colored toga-style gown. Her expression is serious and smoldering. Some of the other execs at Arista thought the photo was too black, but Whitney fought to keep it, and she won. Whitney does everything she can to support the album. Interviews, showcases, meet and greets. She's tireless, even though all she's getting paid from the label at this point is a weekly allowance of $300, which is about $825 in 2022 money. But thankfully, everything about the launch is proceeding like clockwork, and everyone's coming out a winner. Whitney's sharing the gift God gave her with a worldwide audience. Clive's found the diva of his dreams. Sissy's sharing in the fame that eluded her as an artist through Whitney. John's getting the kind of respect he was never afforded through his own job. Even First Lady Nancy Reagan hops on the Whitney train, inviting her to take part in her Stop the Madness drug campaign.
God, the Reagans are such buzzkills.
Yeah, they are. And Whitney doesn't stop the madness. She's still getting high, just not as often as before, given her busy schedule. But so far, cocaine has gone where she's going. Whitney knows doing the anti-drug campaign makes her a hypocrite, but she can't give up the publicity opportunity.
That would be like you agreeing to an anti-napping campaign.
I would never. But Whitney can't say no. She's getting pretty good at being all things to all people. But it doesn't leave much room for herself. And getting high helps. It's October of 1985 in New York City. Whitney Houston is preparing to take the stage at Carnegie Hall, and she should be over the moon. Her second single, Saving All My Love for You, has just hit number one on the Hot 100. And she's headlining at Carnegie Hall. It's something she's dreamed about all her life. But instead, she's on edge. Outside on the sidewalk, the Reverend Al Sharpton and a small group of folks are banging on buckets and carrying signs that say Whitey Houston. Their beef isn't actually with Whitney. They're protesting the white promoters behind the show. But they're dragging Whitney into it, which makes her feel confused and resentful. Why is this my problem? Whitney gripes to Robin in her dressing room. What do they want me to do?
Great question.
Yeah, a really good one. And there's another problem, too. Whitney's older brother, Gary, is supposed to sing backup and perform a few duets with her in tonight's show. But he never showed up for soundcheck, and he's still nowhere to be found. Backstage, Whitney can hear crew members on the walkie-talkies asking, "Anyone got eyes on Gary?" But no one does. Gary's drug problem is a bit of an open secret. A few years back, he was a promising basketball player for the Denver Nuggets, but he failed a drug test and got kicked off the team. Singing backup for his baby sister is a bitter come down. But now that he's a no-show, Whitney is spiraling. Whitney's stage manager gives her the 5-minute warning. "Thank you, Five," she says, and she steps into the wings. But Gary's still not there. Sweat rolls down Whitney's face. This is her big moment, and it's about to be ruined because her brother can't get it together. As the curtain starts to rise, that's when she finally hears Gary's voice behind her. He's here, right in the nick of time. Whitney can see from his bloodshot eyes that he's high, but there's no time to delay. The siblings go out on stage to massive applause. And to Whitney's amazement, Gary doesn't miss a single cue. His voice sounds as smooth and melodic as it always does. If anything, his performance is even better than usual. Until now, Whitney's always believed that performing high is a line she should never cross. Getting on stage high would be disrespecting her gift. But as she watches Gary sing his heart out, she starts to think, maybe she can do both the things she loves at once.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This is episode 1 of our 4-part series, Whitney Houston, Destiny of a Diva. We use many sources when researching our stories, including Remembering Whitney by Sissy Houston and The Soundtrack of My Life by Clive Davis. But we especially recommend A Song for You by Robin Crawford and the documentary Whitney, directed by Kevin MacDonald. A quick note about our scenes. Some scripted dialogue has been added for narrative cohesiveness.
And don't forget, our brand new Even the Rich merch store is now live. We've got cropped hoodies, comfy joggers, phone cases, champagne flutes. You can find it all at WonderyShop.com. Be sure to tell your friends.
I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Sifrin. Dennis Hensley wrote this episode. Editing is by Julia Wolf. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design is by Sam Ada. Desi Blaylock is our production coordinator. Our managing producers are Tanja Thigpen and Matt Gant. Kate Young and Rachel Engelman are our series producers. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new kids and family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.